And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton on the FM dial here at 93.3, and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And as I said earlier, we're going to be catching up with an old friend on the radio program today. We're going to be speaking with Canadian author and activist Eve Engler. I think we've got him on the line. Hi, Eve, can you hear me?
How's it going, Brennan?
It's going well. How about you?
Pretty good.
Yeah, I think there is some background noise, but it's okay. You're in transit right now. You're on your way to another destination.
I am, unfortunately. Well, unfortunately, I'm on my way to Vancouver, but I'm in transit. Yes.
Well, all of our longtime listeners are, of course, familiar with Eve, but it's been a few months. We're just starting up our summer season, reconnecting with some people. Most of us should know who Eve is. I've called him Canada's Noam Chomsky. I mean, if it wasn't for Eve, we'd have about half the activist books that we have now. How many books have you actually written, Eve?
Seven.
Seven. One of the first had to do with sports, right? From Rink Rat to Radical.
It had to do with student activism, playing left wing from Rink Rat to Student Radical, mostly about student activism at Concordia University and other topics.
Right, and we've covered a whole range of subjects on this program and at book launches in Hamilton and all over Canada. Your books have involved Haiti, Canada in Haiti. They've involved Canada and Israel. They've involved peacekeeping. What is your latest book?
My latest book is The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy, which is obviously a criticism of Stephen Harper's aggressive, militaristic, pro-mining, pro-tar sands, pro-empire foreign policy. And that came out about 8 or 9 months ago.
Yes, I remember the poster for that. I was looking at some old advertisements. Certainly that launched here, and it was a hit. You covered a wide range of topics in that book, the foreign policy, domestic issues, the environment. As the Taylor Report said, Harper, you know, with his gratuitous gutting of environmental protocols, he's running out of feet to shoot. And, you know, we're seeing that continue to unfold, unfortunately, for us here in Canada. Now, the foreign policy dimension has always been a strong element of your work. And you certainly haven't let down your pen. You have this blog or some kind of writing conglomeration. You have a lot of your articles posted. Well, where can people find that?
EveEngler.com. Most of my stuff appears there. Usually also appears on places like Dissident Voice and Rabble.ca and Counterpunch and ZNet. So, but EveEngler.com is my site, I guess.
Yes, our listeners should get familiar with all of those publications. But EveEngler.com, I mean, that's really easy to remember. Eves is Y-V-E-S-E-N-G-L-E-R.com. There's a lot of articles, and as far as I can tell, there's no radio program in Canada that's fully caught up on everything you've been doing lately. I really like to help out there. It's hard to tell where to start. The conservatives have been going big on Korea recently. There's the bonking around in the Caribbean. I mean, basically, Canada's been picking fights all over the world, hasn't it?
Certainly the Harper government takes a very, you know, aggressive foreign policy, and they want to be kind of act like a tough guy. That what you're referring to in the Caribbean, there's information that came to light a few months ago about Canadian naval ships patrolling in Jamaican waters, and actually even the former Jamaican prime minister, who was on his personal boat, was actually commandeered by Canadian troops or a Canadian naval vessel in just outside of Jamaican waters. But it came to light at the time that the Canadian warships were active in Jamaican waters, obviously without the okay from Jamaica, and that's just, you know, one example of a sort of, we don't hear about gunboat diplomacy in this country, but there's actually, or in the, you know, in the dominant media, but there's actually a history of Canadian gunboat diplomacy in the Caribbean, which I go through in an article about this recent incident where the Canadian naval vessel commandeered a boat from the Jamaican prime minister. And there's a long history of Canadian gunboat diplomacy in the Caribbean. You see some of that in off the coast of Iran today. You have reports about Canadian naval vessels running provocative maneuvers off the coast of Iran. You know, obviously as part of this campaign by the U.S. and Israel to destabilize the Iranian government, if you like. It's I argue it's a sort of a low level war that's being waged against Iran. And obviously that, you know, comes along with very aggressive comments by our foreign minister, prime minister, directed at Iran, you know, a whole series of different diplomatic maneuvers, cutting off the diplomatic relations with Iran, ending all trade with Iran, which they did very recently, openly talking about how they're organizing the opposition within the country, the Canadian government hosting a website to organize the opposition in Iran, you know, to the former Shah, the son of the former Shah, being on tour in Canada. So you know, the from Jamaica to the Middle East to Iran, you have a very outward Canadian foreign policy, and the Conservatives are setting up military bases in up to 7 countries around the world to be better capable of deploying force, you know, whenever they deem fit. So you're seeing that, and in the case of Korea, what you're referring to is you have the Canadian government sending out a press release, which thanks for sending that to me, Brendan, about the celebrating the anniversary of the Korean War, sending Canadian troops to Korea. This is a war that left 3 or 4 million people dead. This is a war that was, the brutality of it is almost beyond comprehension. At one point, the Americans stopped bombing North Korea because they had intelligence that all buildings of more than 2 stories had been destroyed. This is, you know, we have lots of examples of open racism from Canadian troops. There were 27,000 or so Canadian troops that were sent to Korea. Open racism of these troops, saying all kinds of very horrendous things, all kinds of examples of committing serious crimes, even against allied South Koreans, and no repercussions from Canadian troops.
Yeah, the perception of Koreans in general among the Canadian forces and other allied armies in the region was very problematic, as you point out. We're actually touching on a number of subjects here. I should let you take a breath. The Caribbean incident that you referred to earlier, I mean, the idea here is no matter where this Dudley Do-Wrong goes blundering around the world, whether it's Korea or the Caribbean or whatever, you know, you run into a prime minister's boat in the Caribbean and you think, well, what's that guy doing there? You know, as if we're the ones who have the right to be there in our warships. And, you know, what are all these people doing? What are these Iranians doing off the coast of Iran?
Yeah, no, it's the Iranians that are supposedly intimidating the Omani, it's not the Canadians that are intimidating the Iranians. But I think that's really like, that's the, you know, at the end of the day, that's the imperial mindset. And one example of Canada sending a gunship to Barbados is in this article about Jamaica that I wrote recently about sending a gunship to the coast of, to Barbados's independence ceremony back in the 60s, and the idea was to make sure that no other country, referring most likely to Cuba, interfered with Barbadian independence. You know, Canada sending gunship, that was not, you know, in any way interfering with their independence. But if Cuba was to do so, or whatever other country. So there's a pretty deeply held, it's not just with the Harper government, within Canadian foreign policy, of this sort of imperial mindset, that we sort of, with the big force down south, we run the world. And what you have with the Harper government is just the extension of that type of mindset and that type of policy.
Yeah.
Where, aggressive policy is pursued on behalf of Canadian corporate interests all around the world.
We're spending more money on the military than we've spent in a long time, maybe since Korea or the Second World War. You mentioned the 7 or so military bases they want to set up without really consulting us. The Korean War was, this is something the Conservatives love. And as you say, our government right now is commemorating the beginning, the outbreak of the war. That's what they want to commemorate, not the end of hostilities, you know, not some kind of Remembrance Day thing when people put down their arms and went away. They want to commemorate the outbreak of the war. I guess they're really excited to get in there. And well, you know, I mean, we had an outgoing general not too long ago say that Canada's ready for the next war. You know, we're scrapping for a fight. Bring us the next one. We're not scared, you know, and that seems to be the mindset this government is promoting. Well, what, I guess on the Korea thing, our government said that we can be thankful for this intervention in Korea. There'd be no Gangnam Style if it hadn't been for the sacrifice of Canadians and the members of the United Nations who fought off communism. So, I mean, we can ask, was it worth it for Gangnam Style? But also, you also laid out the sort of history of how we led into the Korean War. That didn't have to happen. You know, the activities of our big brother down south, you know, they weren't so benign even after the Second World War. I mean, what was their policy towards Korea and China?
Yeah, I mean, basically, well, obviously, there's a 100-year history of Western imperialism in China that to a large extent ends with the communist revolution in 1949, which was really a nationalist revolution in China. But in the case of Korea and after the nationalist revolution in China, the Americans became particularly concerned about their control in that part of the world. It's not like they hadn't, you know, they already were, you know, influential and very imperialistic in that part of the world before, but it became that much more so. And after World War II, in the case of Korea, the Americans obviously took control of southern Korea, and the Soviets, or the Russians, should I say, took control of northern Korea, and the Americans followed a very if you like, sort of almost pro-fascist type policy in terms of supporting lots of the former Japanese forces in southern Korea and putting down the left wing movement and wanted to maintain their control of South Korea, even though the Moscow said it was wanted to have proposed a number of occasions to withdraw foreign troops from Korea. The U.S. basically tried to use the United Nations to continue to advance their policy in Korea of occupation. And Lester Pearson, who was a high official in the Canadian, the head of the Canadian External Affairs, the lead bureaucrat, and then became the External Affairs Minister, he fully supported U.S. policy of using the UN and getting Canada involved in elections that were rejected by much of the population, certainly rejected by the North and much of the population as being dubious elections, much of the population in South Korea. And so Canada got involved. Actually, interestingly enough, Prime Minister Mackenzie King was very ambivalent towards Canadian participation. He saw very clearly what the U.S. was doing, and Lester Pearson and external minister Louis Saint-Laurent, who obviously later becomes Prime Minister, pushed hard to have Canada intervene. This is before the actual full-on war. And then after the Chinese Revolution, 1949, the U.S. basically tried to use the tension between North and South Korea, the different regimes there, to launch a full-scale war and try to weaken, contain, if you like, China. And 27,000 Canadian troops were sent in mid 1950, in August of 1950, 27,000 Canadian troops were deployed. Millions and millions of people killed in a brutal 3-year war. And to a large extent, you see some of the legacy of that war still today. Obviously, there's still, I think, 35,000-40,000 American troops based in South Korea. There's still a whole lot of tension at the border between North and South Korea. And China, supports what is a very seemingly erratic or seemingly sort of obviously very repressive regime in North Korea. And China supports the regime in North Korea in large part because it's worried that if it doesn't, there'll be 40,000 U.S. troops right on its border with North Korea.
Yeah, well, it seems, I mean, the U.S. never leaves wherever it sends its troops. It doesn't leave South Korea. It doesn't leave Germany. It hasn't left Iraq. It hasn't left Afghanistan. You know, the troops don't leave, just like no one ever leaves NATO. But you've brought up a number of issues with regard to the history. And, you know, in the immediate post-World War II period, you said that Canada, United States, Britain, they pursued this pro-fascist policy. You know, people throw that word around, fascism. But, I mean, what you're saying is we put in these Japanese army elements, the people that we had been fighting in the war against fascism, we put them in charge in places like Korea.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not just in Korea. There's other places where U.S. pursued that policy. And the basic point is not that the desire to support fascistic elements or necessarily some big ideological commitment, but the point is a support for hierarchy and a support for those who will be our allies, whether they're fascists, whether they're capitalists, whatever exactly it's called. The point is that it's about advancing the interests of Western Washington-led geostrategists, and usually right behind there are the Western corporations that are the main decision makers of Canadian U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, we're going to have to get to that in a minute to elaborate a little bit on the Korea thing. We got into this war. The whole division, the whole thing where you have North Korea and South Korea, that wasn't supposed to happen, really, like, necessarily. You said the Soviets, they tried to pull out a few times. They wanted all the troops to go out. I guess they thought Korea would leave them alone, or Korea would be on their side. They'd win elections. Did we create South Korea, or how did we get this election situation?
Well, there's a UN sponsored elections, which was really the U.S. pushing. And it was to have elections just in the South, which was basically a process of legitimizing or creating the false distinction between North and South. There was no distinction between North and South. It's just the line was up to the American troops were stationed up to a certain point, and Russian troops were stationed up to another point. That's the distinction. There's no sort of cultural or historic distinction beyond that. And we supported elections, UN-sponsored elections, that were about really sort of solidifying that distinction. And obviously that's a distinction that continues on until today. So there's still obviously a lingering effect of that policy, and the lingering effect of the apprehension in North Korea to Washington, because their country was their part of the country of North Korea was absolutely obliterated by U.S. bombers, with Canadian and a number of other countries supporting that, what was just a monstrous war effort against I think left one in 10 Koreans dead, just an incredible level of death and destruction.
Right. They basically blasted every single building in North Korea. I mean, they ran out of things to bomb after a certain point, I think, or something. I mean, they basically pulled a Vietnam in there. They were using napalm and things like that, even in the 50s in Korea.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a book called Orienting Canada, which deals with Canadian relations towards Southeast Asia, and it goes into the different. There's a very hotly disputed allegations of different chemical weapons being used by the Americans, and the Americans have always denied it. But there's information in that book that discusses that Canadian officials had a certain degree of kind of knowledge of American use of chemical weapons, or suspecting of American use of chemical weapons, and they played a very deceptive game in terms of trying to deny the situation, even though they knew there was a strong strong evidence to suggest that was the case. There was, you know, very aggressive. Lester Pearson was very aggressive towards anti-war groups in this country that were denouncing the crimes taking place in Korea. He actually went publicly. This is the foreign, you know, external affairs minister at the time. He publicly denounced one of these groups at the University of Toronto and called on people to basically take over and destroy this anti-war organization. Very, very authoritarian type kind of attitudes. And it was really, all in the service of justifying and advancing this war taking place in Korea, which was tied into a broader American policy to contain China and to maintain their influence in that part of the world.
Yeah, as you point out, one of the first things that we did after China had that revolution in 1949 is we enhanced the ring of military bases or construction in that area. We've been encircling them for a long time, of course. The attitude towards Asians in general, or Southeast Asia, I mean, there wasn't even too much distinction about Korea, what was happening within Korea, what was happening within China. The attitudes of the military towards the populations they were ostensibly protecting foreshadowed a lot of what we saw in Vietnam, as you point out. So I guess now you got two halves of a country pointing guns at each other, and they've been doing that for a long time. You have foreign troops, and you had Canadian soldiers who died to push this all forward. But it was all worth it because we have Gangnam Style.
That is the opinion of the conservative government.
Right. Well, I guess the, yeah.
Somewhat unbelievably, but that is the opinion. And I think the minister who made this comment made it at a celebration of veterans in Quebec City. I think he made it. I'm assuming in a somewhat flippant way, but I think that the underlying point is that there. One, the underlying point is that the political culture in this country is so confused that one could celebrate the Korean War. We've done such a poor job of explaining what Canada did in Korea, and the media so follows the government line so closely that you could promote the Korean War as some good thing. That's one thing. And also, it's, I think, just reflective just to how militaristic this government is and sort of every war. I mean, they do that with the First World War. They go on about the wonders of the First World War, how wonderful. Well, the First World War was the level of death and destruction and even internal resistance that it led to, where, huge opposition in Quebec to forced conscription, to people being, Ginger Goodwin, labor leader, being killed out in BC because he was opposing the war. This is, but yet it's celebrated today as this great thing, creating of the nation. That's Steve Harper.
Yes, every single one of these is a great nation building achievement for Canada. The Korean War, the First World War, the War of 1812. I mean, all of these, there's some story about some heroic Canadian, Laura Secord. It makes it all so that we can celebrate it in our elementary schools and all the brave people and not learn any lessons and do it again. And, I guess if 1,000 or so Canadians die in Afghanistan over the next year or some other Middle East problem that our government is keeping us in, that'll be a great nation building event for Canada too.
Yeah, well, if we let the military and the sycophants of power write history, then there will be, and we'll keep going through the same problems. But that's why it's so important that people who are not just serving military interests and different powerful interests that we write the history of what's actually taking place, and we also talk about the resistance. There was resistance, much less resistance than today towards Afghanistan. And there was opposition to the war, and Lester Pearce, was very hostile to that opposition. And I think in many ways there's some very positive developments in terms of there's much more international solidarity today than there was 60 years ago with Korea. And we have we've become more internationalist. We've become less racist, and the military is not able to fight in as violent a way. As terrible as what's gone on in Afghanistan or the destruction of Libya was and it is, it's not as horrendous as the way the Canadian military fought in Korea. And I think that's in large part because solidarity activism over the past 60 years has to some extent civilized the Canadian military. You know, far from where it needs to be, of course. But there has been some sort of civilization. Carpet bomb entire villages in the same kind of way they did. And obviously, if you look at what happened in Libya, you see serious war crimes. But it's on a much lesser scale, and that's something that we need to build on. As we need to continue to to build the international solidarity, continue to oppose militarism. So I think that in some ways, there's some positive developments in the political culture, but still you see a situation where the history is overwhelmingly written by the militarists, and therefore we have this, nonsensical celebration of Korea, the Korean War, among others.
Yeah, we do have to keep pushing on the issue of casualties, how wars are conducted, staying out of wars. It's just about time to go. You mentioned the corporate interests. We say imperialism. Harper's doing this because of imperialism. What does that mean? Well, you point to the activities of certain corporations and how the military is structuring the world to serve their interests. In your blog, you've been looking at Harper as the biggest lobbyist for oil or certain types of oil industry. You've been looking at some of the other activities. Briefly, what's Harper doing for our corporations abroad?
Well, the most intense examples recently would be, the mining sector, where the Canadian government is diverting Canadian aid dollars to support mining companies in very controversial projects, spending millions of dollars to, help write countries' mining codes to better serve foreign mining interests, which are largely Canadian mining companies. All kinds of different forms of diplomatic support for the mining sector. And then I think the other example is this incredible lobbying for tar sands interests and opposition to any attempt to reduce the amount of carbon from fuel in both Europe, in the European Union, and in the U.S. Obviously, the most intense example is with the Keystone Pipeline and all the tens of millions of dollars in Canadian money, public money that's gone into lobbying to have Barack Obama accept the Keystone Pipeline, but also opposition to the Fuel Quality Directive and many other attempts to reduce the amount of carbon emissions from fuel in the European Union, the Fuel Quality Directive there, and I think that's part of understanding the more aggressive Canadian foreign policy over these recent years is the rise, the huge increase in Canadian mining investment around the world. Tens and tens of billions of dollars of Canadian mining investment around the world. In Africa, gone from about $250 million in 1989 to over $30 billion in Canadian mining investment today. Similar kind of numbers in Latin America, just huge increases. And I think that's in large part what's driving a more aggressive Canadian foreign policy, because the capitalist class, the corporate class in this country is so heavily invested in Latin America, in Africa, and around the world, that they are concerned that there's the opposition of the social movements of the governments that want to have higher royalty rates on natural resources, who want to maybe nationalize mines, who want to the communities that are resisting these projects. And so there's an increasing interest in maintaining this really strong capitalist, so-called free market kind of model. And I think that explains in large part, or in part at least, the more aggressive foreign policy you're seeing over the past decade in this country.
Well, it's good to know that our government is representing somebody. They're putting on a lot of hard work for someone. Well, okay. Well, we caught you in transit and everything. We got to let you go soon, but this is great. We're all caught up now, so next time we can talk about whatever your latest new article or book is. So we really appreciate this. It's great to talk to you, Yves. Thanks so much for being on the program today.
Thanks a lot for having me, Ben.
Thanks, Yves. Bye-bye. That is Canadian author and activist Yves Engler, author of, 7 books, he said? You should definitely own at least half, 3 or 4 of those.